And I love that you have those studies, too, that happen with using probiotics.
And the number, again, to get that product, to show your support to this radio station, is 212-209-2950, or go to give to WBAI.org online. Moving on to the next program, it is now 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook. Coming up, WBAI New York, WBAI.org.
Hello, you're listening to WBAI in New York. It's 7 o'clock. It's time once again for Off the Wall. Did I say off the wall? I meant off the hook. Wrong show, wrong station, but the right day.
Cut myself while shaving. Now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much work. But if they could, they would. So did we bounce for the best to say the words. I hope that's understood. But did we know?
Had to happen eventually. Hang on, let's get our audio together. This is Emmanuel. Yes, I'm sorry, this is the wrong program. I do another radio show called Off the Wall, and that's not this show. This is Off the Hook, right? I'm in the right place. It's Emmanuel, joined by Kyle.
Yes,
and
yes, I'm joining you.
Over in Skypeville, we have Rob P. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Hello.
And over in Skype land, we have Alex.
Hello, hello.
Well, happy 2022. We're a bit flustered, but that's to be expected. How's this year been so far, 11 days in?
Productive.
Okay, well, we haven't learned to not talk over each other, but we'll get there. Kyle, you first.
Oh, I said productive.
Uh-huh. Okay. Good, good.
Yeah.
All right. And Rob, you said?
I said busy.
Busy, okay.
It's almost like productive.
It can be. It can be.
Off to a start.
What would be more productive is if you had a louder microphone, I'll say that. How do we do that?
Okay, I'll see what I can do about that.
Okay, just get a little closer. Okay, well, we have a lot of things to discuss tonight. And, of course, we have Overtime, which will be following this show on YouTube on our channel 2600. You can go over there, and you can wait. You can just lie and wait for the show to begin at 8 o'clock there, and you can call us and ask questions and tell stories and things like that. That runs from 8 o'clock until whenever. But this show, where we aren't able to take phone calls at the moment, I hope that changes fairly soon, we'll be discussing various news items. Who's the wise guy calling now? You're not going to get through now. I see the phone ringing. No, it's not going to go anywhere. There's no point, no advantage to that at all. We have a bunch of interesting news items that we want to get to this hour. And I guess, you know, the elephant in the room. Did anybody see this this Vice News story that came out yesterday about an ethical hacker convention? They're referring to DEF CON, and they're saying that this ethical hacker convention is fueling Donald Trump's big lie regarding elections. And it annoyed a lot of people. Got to say, it annoyed a ton of people. It annoyed me, and I imagine it annoyed you guys as well. Let me give you the gist of it, and we can discuss this a little bit, see what is wrong with it and what might be right about it. this is how the article begins. 19 tables were spread across a ballroom the size of an Olympic swimming pool, each with its own set of voting machines. That's how you start an article. You just have all this illustrative narration, Olympic-sized swimming pools. Yeah, hackers crowd around them, tinkering, unscrewing, and more or less destroying anything with a power button. Yeah, that's what we do. This is the Voting Village at DEF CON, the annual Ethical Hacker Conference in I hate that phrase, ethical hacking, so much, but we'll get into that later. The Ethical Hacker Conference in Las Vegas, and one of the few places where pretty much anyone has permission to do whatever they please to equipment that would otherwise be locked away. Well, okay, if that is the case, that's a good thing, but we'll continue here. With its made-to-be-shared antics, the village that's devoted to hacking voting machines regularly produces viral tweets and national headlines. It also has quick impact. Following demonstrations at the convention in 2017, Virginia's Department of Elections recommended decertifying some of its machines effective immediately. Multiple types of DREs, some of which are currently in use in Virginia, were hacked, according to public reports from DEF CON, the agency wrote. Now, before the 2020 election, these stunts were vaguely concerning to the general public, but largely confined to the elections industry. This has since changed. After former President Donald Trump's defeat in 2020, material from DEF CON is now being used to sow the big lie that Trump actually won the election. Last year, Trump tweeted a video from the conference to support his baseless accusations of fraud. Many of the village's experts, like one of its organizers, Harry Hursty, were approached by lawyers working to challenge the results of the 2020 election. Even if they refused to cooperate, their work was included in the infamous Kraken legal briefs that were supposed to prove the presence of widespread voter fraud. They did not. Now, at DEF CON, the experts agree there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election, and many have worked hard to debunk those conspiracy theories. But with its sensationalist rhetoric, flashy theatrics, unstructured hacking, and lack of structured hacking is not hacking, but never mind. A lack of context about how elections operate, DEF CON also emphasizes the vulnerabilities that are possible, even when they're not necessarily probable. As a result, the event serves as easy fodder for dis- and mal-information, showing how even well-intentioned experts are being used to prop up the big lie. Okay, you know, there are just so many things here. First of all, this set of guidelines and rules that apparently this hacker conference is violating in the writer's eyes, it's utter nonsense. Flashy theatrics, unstructured hacking, lack of context, you know, that's not their job. Okay, that's the job of the journalist, of somebody who is covering this and interpreting the results. What you see in a hacking village, such as the kind they have here, is basically experimentation. Can this machine be compromised? And you know, it's not about nuance. It's not about how do we play this particular story. What kind of headline? No, can this be done theoretically? Whether it's practical or not, that's not what's relevant at the moment. And that is the purpose that they serve. And that's what I think this article misses, is that this is not about backing one side versus another. This is about showing where potential flaws in the system lie. Now, you say, okay, Trump is using this. Yeah, Trump will use anything to try and get his way. It doesn't make it valid. And I think that's another thing that they miss here. That, yeah, he's trying to use that. That doesn't mean that you should call into question the act itself of trying to compromise this technology. That is a healthy thing. That is something that we have an obligation to do. And whether or not Trump misinterprets that or lies to his followers about that, that should not in any way affect what we try to do as hackers. And, you know, it's a shame to see something like this come out and just get it so wrong, and to imply that somehow hackers are helping Trump with his lie. No, nobody in this community is consciously going out and helping Trump with his lies that I am aware of. And it's, I don't know, do you guys have any strong feelings on this? Rob?
Yeah, I mean, Harry Hursty, first of all, he's a heck of a guy, known in the election machine hacking scene. He's spoken to multiple hosts about the subject. And yeah, he runs the hacking, the election hacking village at DEF CON. But yes, I mean, pointing out the security flaws in something, pointing out how something is designed poorly, how something is not implemented right, how something is unsafe, is not the same as making it unsafe. And the hacker world has tried time and again to get this through the head of people who want to write up reports like this, just blaming the shady hackers who are there to publicize what's wrong with the scene. And, yeah, that issue is ongoing and longstanding and long predates anything that Trump has done politically or otherwise. It's always been the case.
Also, I was just going to say, in terms of, like, fact-checking this thing, Harry Hursty, I would not say, is really known for flashy theatrics.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a person, he's not that guy.
Yeah, and it's really unfair to expect that a bunch of hackers or people just trying to educate others on voting technology, that it's their job to to be flashy, or to do things in a particular way to spin a story. These are the facts, okay? The evidence is being presented. Now, journalists out there, good journalists, will take those facts and interpret them and not paint these false alliances that simply call everything into question and make it so that, the conclusion is don't do it. Don't hack. Don't try and find these weaknesses in the system, because if you do, someone else is going to say that it benefits them. And this is something we've been battling for decades, basically forced ignorance, keeping things quiet. And if you reveal a security flaw, then you're the problem. Then you're the one that is responsible for it somehow. And I expected better. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, on that very point, Emmanuel, I think revealing a security flaw is what we do. It's our duty. We share that type of information. And there is a very big difference between a potential vulnerability in a voting system and an actual exploit. And we've been pointing out for many, many years, and among our ranks are Harry Hursty, other people like Matt Blaze, who's a world-recognized election security expert, who's on the Speaker Selection Committee at HOPE and a friend of all of ours, as is Harry Hursty. I've been on Yahoo Finance News with Harry Hursty talking about election security issues a couple of years ago. And in fact, I even debated the executive director of the New York City Board of Elections ahead of the 2016 election about whether elections could be hacked. And one of the things I mentioned were these DRE voting machines, these direct recording electronic voting machines, where if you don't have a paper trail, it becomes very difficult to audit these things. These are issues that came up in the 2016 election. But in the 2020 election, people like Chris Krebs lost their jobs at CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, for coming out against Trump and saying, on the record, that we did not see any election interference here, that looking at all of the data, we didn't see any vulnerabilities exploited by a foreign actor. And remember, one of the things that we talk about every 2 years or every 4 years whenever there's an election is that this is a very much a patchwork of systems across the United States. The patchwork of systems prevents there from being some universal exploit applicable to all voting systems. And so with that in mind, that patchwork becomes a bit of a feature, not necessarily a bug. There's lots of security features that go into, or security precautions that go into voting systems, and they are by far certainly not perfect. But pointing out the imperfections is a far cry from supporting Trump and supporting the lie that somehow the election was stolen. It's a sad day to see a Vice article like this, because Vice motherboard has really been, I think, a friend of the information security community and a friend of the hacker community. And I believe that this nonsense about an ethical hacker convention comes from Vice in general and not necessarily motherboard. Rob, would you know more about that?
Let's see. No, this appears to be a Vice News piece rather than it's not under the motherboard banner.
Yeah, and I think that explains a lot here.
Uh-huh.
Given that, you know, people like Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchieri, are not on the bylines of this, I think, you know, we shouldn't paint Vice motherboard with the same brush, I think, that we are tempted to paint Vice with in general because of this article.
If I could just step in, this is something that I know we tweeted this yesterday about how Vice News is better than this, and we got all kinds of blowback on that, saying, "Oh no, they're not. They're the worst. They're horrible." You know, if they're terrible, who is good exactly? We seem to have a real problem with giving anyone credit for doing good journalism. If I say, "Okay, the New York Times does a good job," now I'm going to get the same people saying, "Oh, they're terrible too." Okay, you know. Conservatives have Fox, and they have OAN, they have all kinds of things that they just line up behind. I'm not saying we should line up behind anyone blindly, but we do have to be able to learn degrees of awfulness and say, well, okay, you know, Vice News really did a bad job here, and they've done bad jobs on other things, but they're still better than Fox News. We can't seem to say that, and that's a problem. That's a problem that we can't ever seem to offer praise for something that occasionally gets it right. And, you know, Vice News Tonight, I don't know if that's different than Vice News or Vice Motherboard. I can't keep track of it all, but I do know that they do a very good job, and I'm not afraid to say so. Rob?
And this reporter, I mean, they linked to a Washington Post story talking about Harry Hursey going to the cybersecurity symposium by the idiot with the pillows, who was a very good friend of Trump, apparently. But in that article they linked to, Hursey himself is quoted as, because he went to the conference, and he's quoted by the reporter as saying, "This is a big fat nothing. It's a distraction. They fed us with garbage just to control with the narrative." You know, making clear that he is not in any way on board with helping Trump, you know, spread the big lie. He was there in his capacity as an expert on these matters to take a look at things, see what they were saying. He saw what they were saying. He was not impressed.
And it's like the evidence is all this like fabricated stuff, whereas you know, people wanting to analyze the stuff and create better access to share information and have more transparent systems are somehow suspect. It's a pretty huge paradox or irony there.
You know, and to that point, Kyle, I think, you know, the very idea of the Voting Village in DEFCON is dedicated to identifying these potential vulnerabilities and publishing them so that they can be corrected and so that they do not become actual exploits that can affect an election. So the idea about this is to protect elections from interference, to ensure election integrity, to point out these potential vulnerabilities, to secure democracy, not to undermine it in the way that this article seems to be insinuating that it's doing, and it's very unfortunate.
Go ahead, Gail.
It also kind of strikes me as a similar sort of line of thought to the governor of Missouri, that if you found this problem, it is clearly a problem that you are causing and seeking to exploit.
You want to just tell that story for those listeners who might not be familiar with this? It's classic.
Okay, so somebody jump in and correct me if I get the facts wrong, but if I'm remembering correctly, what happened was a reporter in the state of Missouri was on a state website and clicked into the source code and found a vulnerability and reported it to the state. And the governor freaked out and tried to sue him or arrest him.
He's calling him a hacker as if that's an insult. Yeah. And, and not backing down, doubling down, in fact, saying that he committed a crime by clicking View Source in a browser. So, kids, if you're looking at a browser, don't click View Source. You could be committing a crime by pressing a button on your own damn browser in this guy's world.
So what we're learning is that if you show someone that there is a mistake, clearly you are exploiting that mistake. So, you know, as a person who often sees punctuation and grammar issues in the world at large, apparently I am causing all the problems when I see a comma splice in the wild.
Only if you try to fix it. Only if you try to fix it. Or if you point it out and ridicule people, yeah, that causes all sorts of unrest. So, yeah, you got to be careful these days. All right, anything else before we move on to another topic?
appreciate the media you have.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a good thing. And make better media, you know? I want to hear, for those all those people that are trashing everything that we mention, point us to something good. Because I say, okay, you don't like that BBC? No, not BBC. Al Jazeera? Who then? Who? Because we're going to wind up with just a mainstream garbage, and we won't have any kind of a choice if you don't support alternatives.
Yeah, I loved your remark when we were first learning about this of, like, you're upset that Vice is going to, they're running through too many jungles and covering thing too many firefights in between gunfire.
No, literally, that's what they do.
Or the reporters translate and code switch into different language, too many languages, too many multilingual reporters.
I don't want to sing their praises, especially after this article. I'm not sure how related it all is, but they have reporters on their nightly news show, which, by the way, is no longer nightly because it's not getting enough support. It's only on two nights a week now, but they have reporters that speak the language of the places that they happen to be in. Try that, NBC. And they literally are running through jungles and embedding with rebels and getting shot at and covering the story. They deserve credit for that. That is good. That is good journalism. And it's not perfect, sure. And they get things wrong, absolutely. But you can't condemn it all. If you condemn it all, you wind up with absolutely no alternatives. I know this from working at WBAI because we try as hard as we can to do a good job here at this radio station. I know that our news department tries their very best with the limited resources they have. And when they get condemned as part of the mainstream media like everybody else, it really hurts. It really hurts because we're trying to do something different. And there are degrees, as I mentioned. There are degrees. NPR, it's better than Fox. It might not be as good as us, but it's better than Fox. And we can admit that. We can say, yeah, you know, if I'm in the middle of Iowa or Idaho or some other state beginning with I, and there's no radio stations except for religion and country music and hate radio on the AM talk circuit, I'm going to be damn happy that I heard an NPR station. You know, that's a good thing. And, you know, in New York City, there are better things, and 99.5 happens to be one of them. By the way, feel free to support us. Go to give2wbai.org or call 212-209-2950. Just figured I'd mention that.
And NPR is not without their travails. I know I think Adi Cornish left. So they have people changing and dynamics there, their own
Vice is the same way. It's all a big revolving door of people leaving and
every newsroom has tumult and politics and change management styles and things like that. That is a part of the media business, but like you said, this is different. Community radio is so crucial. We're constantly trying to improve. We appreciate and take to heart feedback, and it matters because our devotion when we get feedback, it's different when it's not like just a job. It's like, you know, we care. We really do care, and we're going to continue to care. So if you do too, contributing to the station is a great way.
And, you know, when dealing with any media outlet, yes, criticize, critique, figure out ways to make things better, correct the mistakes, and save the blanket condemnation for those that really get it wrong all the time. And there are plenty of candidates for that. Go ahead, Rob.
And just to throw in here, our Tower Fund drive here at WBAI is still ongoing. There is another couple of weeks left in it, and we are specifically raising money to pay our rent on our broadcast tower and keep these airwaves buzzing. So if you go to towerfund.wbai.org, you can get all the info on that and how you can help out.
Just really quickly to echo what everybody has been saying, but also just a reminder in my other hat as a nonprofit development professional. Don't forget, you can get matching gifts from a lot of your employers. You can double or triple your personal impact by matching your gift at the corporate level. All you have to do is provide your employer's match program with the data that you gave this gift to a nonprofit organization, and they will just give free money to that. So find out about Employee Match. That information is also on towerfund.wbai.org. It's a really wonderful opportunity to expand the impact of your personal donation.
How would someone working for a company find out about something like that? Who do they ask? What kind of person do they ask?
I believe that is part of probably the employee benefit structure.
Okay.
Ask around, ask probably HR, just to find out. It's a really wonderful thing that a lot of companies are doing more and more.
But they won't get mad, right? If you're asking, do you have a matching program? It's not like you're taking money from them. They're allocating.
Not
this,
at all.
Right?
Okay. Not at all. That it's a it exists for this reason, and WBAI is a great place for it to go.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, Alex.
Yeah, on the subject of being critical and fair, I won't say fair and balanced because that's the motto of another station.
You can say balanced and fair though. Although, you know, say balanced and fair, and we can reclaim the words that way.
Yeah, that's right. I think balanced in the interest of being balanced and fair, it may seem like we are, you know, pinko liberal, left of left, Trump hating. You know, hippies running around with, you know, Birkenstocks and tie-dye socks all the time here on WBAI. But, I mean, I can recall this station being very, very critical of the Clinton administration and mm-hmm. things like the Communications Decency Act. And, you know, and look, we give it to all sides. And I think that, you know, being critical and being balanced and fair is part of what WBAI does. And I think a lot of people will take issue with that. But all they have to do is go back into the archives of this particular show to realize that it's more than just a left-leaning radio station. It's an important radio station for dialogue, for free speech, and for really, I think, ensuring the protection of democracy. This is what the Pacifica Foundation was designed to do at its inception, which was to use dialogue to try to prevent future wars. That's where the word Pacifica comes from, this notion of being a pacifist through dialogue. That's
and
what we do.
Speaking of fairness, do you remember the organization FAIR? Freedom and Accuracy in Reporting, I believe, is what FAIR stood
yeah,
for.
Yeah, I remember that.
Are they still around? They should be if they're not.
I believe so.
Okay, well, sure. We need to hear more from them.
And vote. If you're not disassembling voting machines to make them better, just use them normally and help others who aren't having as much of a good time voting. And if that means getting some support from legislators, that's a good idea, too.
And just to, you know, put a closing chapter on this whole talk of hacking voting machines, remember that in addition to Trump possibly using the information that is gleaned from this to spread his lies, remember, these people are also taking notes on how they can do it themselves. And that is very, very important because that information is going to get out there one way or another. Far better that it get out to the public so that we can watch for this, so that we can see them and catch them in the act. Because, you know, for all the talk of voter fraud, most of it is coming from that side. Most of the documented cases have been on the right. And it's very disturbing to see that, and it's something that we have to be educated on. Yes, Gila.
It is. It's first of all very, very disturbing to see that. And the other question that I have is, Trump was interviewed on NPR yesterday. Why are we not keeping our eye on the ball here? Like, why is this happening today, yesterday, as he keeps getting more and more places to spread this? Why are we saying that something that is actively not doing that is perpetrating the same fiction? That's my question.
Maybe that's why they're having staffing issues in NPR.
I don't know. Okay. We're going to move on, though. Talking about our favorite subject, Log4j. Remember that from last year? Now, here's a story from the Washington Post, or an analysis. And I guess I'll direct this question to you from this headline. 1 month in, there aren't any huge known Log4j hacks. What's going on, Alex? I thought everything's going to fall apart, that this Log4j was unstoppable and it's everywhere, and we're all going to see the effects of it. And honestly, it's almost 2 weeks into January, and not really seeing much.
So that's a legitimate question. Okay, I see. I thought that was rhetorical. Yeah, look, there have been active threat actors that have been trying to exploit Log4j, and I believe even threat actors such as, you know, very well-known ransomware groups like Conti, as well as many nation states have been exploiting this out in the wild. And so there have been compromises based on Log4j, and there are a lot of people developing exploits for it, but there's also a massive amount of patching that's been going on. There's a directive that came out from CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, with respect to federal agencies that they had to patch essentially before Christmas and then report right after Christmas, I think on December 29th. We had a client alert actually go out about that. And then there was another directive that came out that was directed towards civilian companies, you know, civilian, private organizations about patching Log4j. So there is a massive effort to patch the Log4j exploit. And I think it is a great credit to all of the IT people and all of the information security personnel who have been working literally around the clock since this exploit was released to the public to try to patch and identify where Log4j exists and get the latest version of Log4j implemented within their source code, push it out to the customers. So there has been a lot of tireless work in trying to prevent this from happening. And I think the fact that there has been few exploits that are very well known in the wild is certainly to the credit of all of these men and women that have really been putting their heart into this for several weeks now. That being said, I do predict, and this was one of my predictions at the end of the year of 2021, was that there were going to be variations on the theme of this Log4j exploit. Given the nature of the exploit itself and how embedded it is, it's very likely that advanced cyber adversaries and threat actor groups, or APTs, advanced persistent threats, are actively trying to develop new versions of exploits that this patching won't be able to protect against. New versions of exploits that can be exploited without detection. And so I think that's probably what we're in store for in the months to come.
Does anybody else see a parallel in what Alex just said to the whole DHS way of talking about terrorism? You know, we're going to form this agency. We're going to push the Patriot Act because these terrorists are everywhere and they're going to strike. And, okay, years have gone by and there hasn't been a single incident. It's testament to how good a job we've done. I'm not saying the motivation is the same, but it's a remarkable parallel because it sounds very similar.
Well, it's cogent reasoning, right? I mean, you're looking at the absence of event as proof of something else, right? So it could also be a logical fallacy, right? That, you know, post hoc ergo propter hoc, after something, therefore, on account of it, right? After all of this work, there hasn't been some kind of exploit, therefore, it's on account of all of this work. But I think we would be remiss to all of those in the hacker community and the information security community that listen to this show who gave up their holidays and their Christmases with their loved ones to identify where Log4j was being found within their IT infrastructure, patch it, remediate it, remove it, you know, and generally pull your hair out over this thing because it has been an absolute nightmare for many, many people.
Yeah, but if they sacrificed their holiday with their family, we probably kept them from catching COVID, so you're welcome.
Something like that, sure.
I really hear you, Alex, especially that thing where if you go by exploits alone, you would say it's a mess, right? They've not done a very good job at all if they're really tasked, other than being sort of a reactionary or a warning system of sorts for industry. But there's been a lot of damage, talking about Log4j specifically, but in general, in like the entirety, the whole scope of what DHS does. And, that culture of like saying, well, we're successful because nothing happened is, I think, part of phrasing they use and a lot of the lingo where that speaks to the sort of always vigilant attitude. And, you know, they would probably, or it would be characterized as an ongoing thing. You just haven't seen it because, as you said, as they've characterized, warnings and people have been working really hard. And yeah, and that must be it. I'm not really being that sarcastic either. I'm serious.
Okay, well, moving on. There's apparently a threat with Google Docs. Now, people are aware of this. But a team of security researchers at Avanon.
Researchers.
Researchers. Okay. Did I not say that?
Sort of.
Yeah. Researchers at Avanon are reporting hackers are taking advantage of a Google Docs security vulnerability. Everyone's always sending Google Docs. Everyone's always saying, yeah, you know, I want to show you this, but you got to log on to your Google account and basically team up with other people that are reading the same doc. Well, turns out this particular hack takes advantage of a comment feature. They're claiming they saw hackers using the vulnerability to target 500 inboxes of 30 Outlook users involving over 100 individual email accounts. Those are serious numbers, aren't they? The team at Avanon claims that they found an earlier exploit in Google Docs in June, one that allowed hackers to send phishing links to users. That's phishing with a PH. Then this past October, they discovered that hackers had found another way to send phishing links to unsuspecting users using the comment feature. They further claim that the vulnerability was not fixed by Google, and because of that, they began seeing hackers taking advantage of the vulnerability last month. The hacking approach is both simple and straightforward. A hacker stop saying hacker. Anyone can do this, all right? And the people with bad intent are doing this, but I'll keep reading the way the story is written here. A hacker creates a Google Docs document and adds comments to it that include an @ symbol followed by an email address. The symbol automatically alerts the system to send an email to the person designated in the email address. The email that is sent has phishing links in it, sending the user to a web page that could lead to malicious code. Of course, that only happens if the user receiving the email goes to that link. And if they're using a service that automatically goes to that link, that's a very bad idea. But many of us, most of us, I would hope, would have to actually physically click on the link to get there and make that mistake themselves. Had you folks heard about this particular vulnerability?
No, yeah, but now that I have, you're definitely going to be using it, right?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Composing
you brought
something
it up,
right now.
So you're clearly going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you, Alex.
No, I'm just a little bit confused about it in that I understand how the emails are sent out, but the phishing link is contained within the document itself, so the Google Doc is weaponized.
That's my understanding, that the problem was within the Google Doc, and that by entering that email link, it's automatically sent to those particular addresses with the phishing links included in the doc, and then when they receive the email, they either are magically transported to that phishing link or they go there themselves. And does anybody want to define what a phishing link is for those people who might not know this?
A phishing link is a link that is made to look like something that you would normally trust and put your info in, log into usernames, passwords, personal identifying information, things like that.
I got an email from Amazon today saying I was canceled, and I had to log in to uncancel myself. Was I wrong to do that?
Absolutely, because that's what a phishing link is. And you'll put in, it'll trick you to putting your info in and maybe log you into the real thing. But in the meantime, you've given your personal info to that intermediary who put up the fake site.
Go ahead.
On the other hand, if this is as simple as weaponizing a Google Doc document with phishing links that are contained within it, and then having emails sent out to these users using the @, so they're legitimate emails that come from Google, I'm frankly surprised that it's taken people this long to figure out how to weaponize a Google Doc. It seems like it's a pretty simple exploit, and to my mind. But I'm sure that there are very simple ways of combating this type of exploitation of Google Docs, and that would be simply by having Google scan the document, look for any kind of suspicious links, phishing links, errant domains, anything that would be on their blacklist of domains or websites or malicious URLs for phishing links, and then just cancel that document or remove that link or replace that link.
Well, if I could get some more detail from this article, which comes from TechExplorer.com. The hack works because the email that is sent does not show the hacker's email address, just a name they designate. And because the email comes from Google, users trust that it is legitimate. Big mistake. Most of my spam comes from Google. The same feature also allows the email to sneak its way through spam filters. Now, this is interesting. Victims don't even have to open a Google Docs document to be targeted because they're targeted by what appears to be a friendly email message. To make matters worse, the attacker does not even have to share the document. Just putting a victim's address in a comment gets the job done. Yeah, so I don't know. How do you counter this?
I'm really confused about how this works, frankly. I don't necessarily understand it. Maybe somebody can call us at overtime and explain this exploit to us, because simply putting a user's name in a comment, I don't understand how that would relate to anything malicious.
Well, the team at Avanan reports, and maybe they can call us and clarify some of this, that they say thus far most attacks have involved Outlook, but note it could work equally well for virtually any email system. They also note that to avoid falling victim to such an attack, users need only refrain from clicking on links. The first thing I said, which are embedded in emails that are sent from Google Docs. They closed by claiming that they briefed Google on their findings on January 4th, but the vulnerability has not been fixed. So, folks, don't click on links. I think that's rule number one, without knowing exactly what you're going to.
And always view source.
Well, if you want to be charged with a crime in Missouri, yeah, view source, Kyle, but I don't know. It's dangerous.
I have a theory this isn't as or has become more prevalent because people are maybe using Google Docs more widely. I think initially it was something that maybe people would use in an internal way, and it's more something that's shared and that connected, that linking feature, I think, is what's being exploited here, where contacts lists and so on connect all of these different accounts,
yeah.
Especially when everybody's on Gmail, you have different networks of accounts interacting with others. There's some, you know, secret Google stuff going on there that I think people are noticing or using because it's being relied upon more. They're taking advantage in this case.
I don't care for Google Docs. I don't like having to go on to an external site to read something that someone wants to send to me and then be told, oh, you have to log into Google in order to be able to read this, which many of these docs insist that you do. Right away, there's a lot here that just rubs me the wrong way. All kinds of logging, all kinds of surveillance-type features can be implemented. What's wrong with just sending something to somebody? What's wrong with just regular emails? And, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm anti-new developments here, but there are things that work, and we should continue to use the things that work. If you want to add something else, fine, but you know, forcing everybody to go along on this expedition is ill-advised, I think.
I think the feature of that live editing, the collaborative nature of it, where mm-hmm. you can edit a document live.
Don't like that either.
Yeah, it's a
little
bit...
I don't like editing things with... You know, I'm an editor, so I like to edit without other people editing while I'm editing. Just leave me alone. I'll do it myself.
That is so understandable, and much respect, because the attitude that this is how we edit documents is... It's not for everyone.
You want to collaborate? Let's take down Fox News or something. I'll work on that. Okay, but as far as editing, I don't know. It's just...
That's a Google Doc you can get logged into.
Don't work well with others. I just don't. Alex, go ahead.
All right. So I think I do have a better understanding of how this thing works now. So the when you would put in the @ with a comment, what happens here, and I apologize if I missed this very simple point before, but if you put a comment in that, and the comment itself contains the malicious link, mm-hmm. then the email is sent to the user that's associated with the, you know, the @ username. Then that, because that email is coming from Google, it may be on some kind of trusted whitelist. It's a trusted domain, so it can more easily sail through your email gateway and any kind of filtering for spam or phishing links that would otherwise be in place. Then if the user clicks on that link after it's presumably gotten through your email gateway and come into your inbox, then and only then would the malicious link be activated. So, yeah, the two defenses here are, number one, don't click on the links, and number two, Google should be scanning all of the comments that contain links or any kind of URL for phishing. So really simple protective measures on both counts.
Go ahead, Rob.
You were wondering about the appeal of Google Docs, and it's funny because the general feeling among companies that use it and organizations that use it was sending around like a Word document is often a very a very thin point in computer security, because it's very easy to infect a Word document with malicious things. And so there will be policies in place. You know, never send Word documents around. Instead, just use Google Docs. You don't have to download anything. It's nice and safe. It's like streaming instead of downloading a video or something similar to that. And so when the vulnerability is then located in Google Docs, there's a certain little level of irony in there.
Yeah, that's brilliant. It's encapsulated sort of the comments and the notification being set to and arriving from Google. That in and of itself is a vehicle for the exploit, I guess, through this link in the comments.
The interesting thing to me is I use Google Docs a lot, both in my personal life and my professional life. My family will collaborate on a menu through Google Docs. We'll put together a menu and a shopping list in a Google Doc together. But we never use the comments. I don't know one who uses the comments.
Well, I think you need to send a comment and see what happens.
Well, no, I'm tempted.
Yeah. All right, well, let's cover this story, too. Involves one of our favorite companies, Canon. For years, printers have been encumbered with digital rights management systems that prevent users from buying third-party ink and toner cartridges. We've talked about this a number of times. Printer companies have claimed that their chip-enabled cartridges can, quote, enhance the quality and performance, unquote, of their equipment, providing the best consumer experience and protect the printers from counterfeit and third-party ink cartridges. In actuality, they're able to have them expire before they actually run out, forcing you to buy their overpriced products instead of a reasonably priced alternative. Well, guess what? Requiring first-party cartridges also ensures a recurring revenue stream, and that's a no-brainer right there. To enforce this, they basically embed chips inside the consumables for the printers to authenticate. Here's the deal. Chips are now in short supply. Like now. And Canon has found itself in a bit of a bind. So Canon is now telling its customers how to defeat its own warnings about third-party cartridges. Due to the worldwide continuing shortage of semiconductor components, Canon is currently facing challenges in procuring certain electronic components that are used in our consumables for our multifunction printers in order to ensure a continuous and reliable supply of consumables. We have decided to supply consumables without a semiconductor component until the normal supply takes place again. The chip in question tells the printer when toner levels are getting low, which can be a useful feature, but it's one that printer companies often use to lock out third-party cartridges. Without the chip, the printer will say it doesn't know how much ink or toner is inside the cartridge, assume it's zero, and refuse to print. But Canon has been having a hard time getting chips amid the shortage, so the company is telling owners of its Image Runner large office printers how to defeat its own protections against cartridges that don't have chips. The software on these printers comes with a relatively simple way to defeat the chip checks. Depending on the model, when an error message occurs after inserting the toner, users can press either I agree, close, or OK. When users press that button, the world does not end. Rather, Canon says users may find that their toner cartridge doesn't give them a low toner warning before running empty. Although there are no negative effects on print quality when consumables are used without electronic components, certain additional functions such as the detection of the toner level may be impaired, says Canon. And, so this article comes to us from Tech Policy and Tech Policy Department of Ars Technica. It's great to see this finally happen. Alex?
This whole thing is really ridiculous.
You think?
I don't understand how that could even be considered a security mechanism or a way to block out users if all you have to do is click I agree, okay, or close. The article doesn't mention which one of those you click in order to defeat the alleged security function that locks out third-party competitors. But to my mind, if all you have to do is click on I agree, throw in some third-party toner, and then deal with the fact that you may not get some kind of advanced warning when toner levels are low, that hardly seems like a bona fide effort to lock out competitors.
So your problem is that they didn't do enough to make it impossible for people to use third-party toner.
Well, no, I just don't think that this should be classified in any way as something even remotely resembling some kind of security mechanism, because it seems like no matter what you click at that particular point, you still get to use the toner of your choice. So on the first count, this shouldn't be considered security or locking out a competitor. And on the second count, perhaps we shouldn't be giving Canon kudos for doing the right thing.
Oh, I don't think we were doing
that. Click on anything and get past the security.
If my tone was giving kudos, I was not doing that at all. I don't think this article is doing that. And it's not a security issue at all. The security is bypassing it, because that secures you in being able to use the toner of your choice, as is your right. The only security this is protecting is Canon's own security of forced income from its consumers. Rob?
I love this story so much because as someone who's like worked in the design industry and had a close eye on sort of how printers have evolved since the very early days of personal computers, it used to be that you would just run out of ink and you would try to print something and notice that you were out of ink and go, okay, I'll change my ink. But then printer manufacturers started really wanting to take the razor blade model and upsell you on the cartridges. Mm-hmm. And how do you justify taking what's essentially a tiny plastic bottle with a sponge in it that's full of a few drops of a chemical and charge like $50 for it? And when you add like DRM and stuff, that's corporate evil. But you could also say, well, this has to be expensive. We have a microchip in there. We have digital technology that's actively doing things. And this is sort of like the facade falls away, and they when they realize, oh, you can't get the chips, you know, and you gotta do something to keep your customers functioning. You come out and admit, if you're Canon, that this was all BS to start with, and you could just get past it, rather than all the scary warnings that are like, you'll brick your printer if you use non-canonical ink, you'll destroy things if you use the wrong the cartridge. And
canonical? Do they use that word?
I think that was a joke.
Yeah,
they oughta.
They should.
I'm so hearing that I don't like the warning. Does anyone really appreciate the low ink warning by featurizing it, making it a feature? This thing that just held a powder is somehow whiz bang and authentic, as though not having options to actually have a market where you can decide and maybe have lower prices on certain things, they take that out of the picture because they have a special feature, which isn't really that much of a feature. I'm with you. I don't appreciate a low-level warning. I'll figure it out when I look at it.
Yeah, there you go. Rob?
It's fun. I'm enjoying it.
Okay. Alex, did you have something else?
Oh, I think I appreciate Rob's point on this, and I think I've come to my senses on the Canon article, but looking forward to hearing from our listeners, hopefully on overtime, if they can join us on YouTube. Always fun to get to take phone calls.
Yeah, and we will be going over to YouTube at the Channel 2600 channel. Or you can follow the link that's at the top of the 2600.com webpage. Join us at 8 o'clock, and you can call in and share your stories or ask us questions. Rob, I wanted to ask you a question, actually, concerning the last 2600 meeting. Was there one this month? I know a lot of meetings opted not to meet in person because of Omicron. And we still have a wait-and-see approach right now to see if this variant stops being as prevalent. The predictions are that come February it will start to decline, and I'm hoping that after that we'll start getting back to a more normal type of normal.
Yeah, there were a few people that gathered. It was a small group, I'm given to understand. I was not among them. Instead, I stuck to the virtual meeting, which took place over Zoom like we've been doing as an alternative since the original lockdown. Not many people joined me there. So if you are interested in using the Zoom for future 2600 meetings in the New York area, let us know, because it's something that we need to know if it's still being used, if there's still interest in it, if we should keep it going or not. It did happen, and we're keeping an eye on all the numbers for the next one.
All right, and that's what we're doing here at the magazine and at the conference. holding back a little bit, watching how things develop, but expect some exciting announcements coming up in the weeks ahead as we move forward into 2022. It's going to be a better year than 2021. Welcome, everybody. Write to us, oth@2600.com. See you over on Overtime on YouTube. We'll talk to you on WBAI next week. And remember, support WBAI. Give to WBAI.org. 212-209-2950 to support the station. Good night.